I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge.
Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. Kind of a special holiday edition because there's nobody here but us. I'm in the studio with doctors Mike Filler and Andrew Cannon. Mike, if you can't hear yourself, the volume pot is under the lip of the counter. Perfect. I have you two in the studio because we've been showcasing your podcast for the past semester. We've played four episodes of the Nanovation podcast, which you produce as a team. Go ahead, jump in there, Mike.
I wasn't going to argue. I was just gonna say that we do. And it's been a great activity for us over the last couple of years.
And Andrew, you are a not from the start addition to Nanovation. You joined after it had been going for a little while.
That's right. Yeah, after Mike had been doing the show solo for about a year, I think. I came on as the editor.
Excellent. And we had a really nice chance to take advantage of the radio and play some episodes of the podcast just to show it off. And so now what I want to do is I want to talk about who you all are and how the podcast was created, how it runs, and what it can and can't do for folks professionally. So let me introduce you more officially. Mike Filler is an associate professor and the Traylor Faculty Fellow in the School of Chemical and Biomolecular Engineering here at the Georgia Institute of Technology. Andrew Cannon is the Director of Technology at 1900 Engineering, which is a company, not a time. You're also a Georgia Tech alumnus, along with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. So, welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right. I'm doing sound checks while you all are talking. So first, let's get a sense of who you are professionally, separate from any podcast that you produce. So, Mike, what do you do for a living?
As you said, I'm a professor of chemical engineering at Georgia Tech. Actually, I'm not sure you said that, but that's my home department. And so while I do teach, of course, at a Tier 1 research institution like Georgia Tech, I do probably 80% of my job is research. And so I run a research laboratory that works on electronics and photonics. And so specifically, we try and develop new manufacturing processes for next-generation electronic and photonic devices.
I think electronic is easy to understand, but photonic, I think we might want a definition for.
Sure. So electronics are integrated circuits, right? The things that are in your phone that do computation and sensing and all this kind of stuff that are now all around us. Photonics is, instead of the use of electrons as in electronics, photonics is the use of light to do different things. And so it can be light detection. It can be light emission, like LEDs are really a photonic device that emit light. That can be photonic computation, using light instead of electrons to do computing. So there's a whole variety of things that would fall into the photonics category.
You're an award-winning teacher, and you said that you do 80%. No, I saw there's actual photographic evidence that you were given an award for your teaching.
That's true.
But you said 80% of your work is research. How does that work out for you?
Well, it's surprising when I tell the students. So when I'm in the classroom, actually, I make it a point to make sure my undergraduates understand that at a place like Georgia Tech, we value teaching a lot, but it is not everything we do. And so when you have good instructors in classes, it means they care a lot about teaching and about your education, because I get no raise based on my teaching. And so you better care about it just because you do to be a good teacher. So I think that's that. But
that's how that works.
That's how that works.
You have students in a research lab, though, that you run.
Correct.
Right. Are you sort of teaching them? Is that how you consider that?
Sure. That's more of a one-on-one mentorship kind of activity, but that's definitely teaching. And that's a lot of what I do as well. So training the next generation of scientists and engineers to go off, whether to academia or to a company, to do good work. And I would argue that a lot of what we do at a place like Georgia Tech while we like to talk about the exciting research we do, is we train the next generation of people to go out and do good things.
Now, is it a generalization to say that you work in nanotechnology, or that that's your field of study?
Right. So we can have that conversation about what is nanotechnology. And it, unfortunately,
I think that'll be through the whole episode.
Yeah. So it's not, I would argue, it's not a great name. And when you say the word technology, it usually refers to something that people can go buy, whether a company would buy it or a consumer would buy it. It doesn't really exist as a technology. So there's the science and there's the engineering of nanoscale objects, but it's really a foundational capability that then goes into lots of technologies. And so it's kind of, you know, in the early days, that name stuck, nanotechnology, but it's kind of a misnomer, right? And what is it and why is it important? I think the easiest way to explain it is, for all of human existence, we've been very good at manipulating macroscopic things, right? From when we lived in caves, we could, you know, wield clubs and build fires and use, you know...
Did you just use macroscopic to describe things?
I did. Okay. Like things you can hold in your hand.
There we go.
Macroscopic. And you know, so we're good at that. We can stick keys into locks, and we can turn those keys and the lock opens. Right? We're very comfortable dealing with things we can see. And then about 200 years ago, we got good at dealing with molecules. So molecules are many, 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 many times smaller, 10 billion times smaller than things we hold in our hand. And that's chemistry. And we got really good at taking molecules and turning them into other molecules. And that was great. But it's kind of interesting to think that these are the extremes, stuff we can hold in our hand and molecules. And then there's this whole middle ground. And the last several decades has been this emergence of being able to control the middle ground. And nano is in that middle ground space. And so nanoscience and nanoengineering are aimed at giving humans the ability to control matter in those intermediate length scales.
And you're doing that and then applying it to electronics and photonics.
That's correct.
And that's what the Filler Lab does, like tries to make it work?
At a very high level, that's what we do, right? Try to understand those processes, try and leverage them to do better things than we can do today.
And if we say, so you teach at Georgia Tech and you run the Filler Lab, are we missing any part of your professional life?
I do service, contribute to societies, help organize conferences. I'll do occasionally public lectures and things like that as part of that service and outreach activity. Then there's the podcast, of course, which we'll talk about. But broadly, it's focused on research. Teaching is critically important, but not the major thrust of what most people do at Georgia Tech. And then, you know, service is scattered around.
And service falls under, or let me flip that around, scholarly communication seems to fall under service, or sort of explaining to the public what you do?
Yeah, in an outreach sense. Yeah. So I would argue that when we write papers on the science we do, that is part of the research activity. When I come on a radio show like this, this is outreach communication to the public.
Always glad to help.
Thank you.
Now, I have to ask all my PhDs that are on the show this. Do you like being called doctor?
No. I don't like being said I was called the trailer faculty fellow. I was just
It was on the website.
No, it was on the website. it makes me sound probably better than I would without the title. I don't know. It depends on who you are, actually, I think. So I was at graduation for the PhDs on Friday last week, and I was just lamenting all the regalia and, you know, just wear the hats and stuff. And so it's kind of like I could do without most of this.
I think that's a perfect segue. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, you are not in academics.
Correct.
But you have all the requisite degrees.
I do. I am an adjunct assistant professor at Clemson University, but that's a minor part of what I do.
Is that teaching or?
Yeah, a little bit of teaching. So we have a lab class, an undergraduate lab class now that we're doing with carbon fiber composites and integrating some carbon nanotubes into those composites. But yeah, that's a small part of what I do.
So what were your degrees in? You got an undergraduate and master's here at Georgia Tech, and then you went to University of Illinois.
Yes, and that was all in mechanical engineering, but...
It's right down the middle.
I've done it right down the middle, so don't knock it.
but really, when I started the master's, it was mostly focused on microfabrication and some nanofabrication. So it wasn't much to do with things you might traditionally think about with mechanical engineering, things like car engines or transmissions. It was things you might associate with your computer chips. So going into a clean room where you can process silicon wafers to do interesting things in the micro world.
Now, is it just sort of a preference that you didn't say electronics just then? Or is there a very clear division between the work that both of you do?
I don't do much electronics, actually.
Okay.
So I'll use the same facilities the electronics people use, but for mechanical purposes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So chips are not electronics? I'm coming from a very dumb place here as I ask these questions.
No, it's okay. So what I'll use those facilities for is creating some fancy rubber stamps that have microscopic patterns on them. Because the people that I worked with, they want to get microscopic patterns onto their parts to do all sorts of things, to run their own tests, to put patterns of proteins down on their parts so they can study how cells interact with those proteins, all sorts of different reasons they want very small patterns on their parts. But they don't want to use the really expensive facility with the very expensive equipment in it that takes a couple months to learn how to use all the stuff. They want to just put the patterns on their parts. And so I'll send them rubber stamps. And so they can just press those stamps onto their parts and get those patterns. So,
is this literally a rubber stamp?
Yes, it's literally a rubber stamp. And so we have collaborators that were spending 57 hours of time on really expensive equipment. And then they started using our stamps, and they spend 15 minutes now. So, it's just a physical stamp that you can press onto your parts and get the patterns on your parts.
So I've backed into your company.
Yeah.
And that's 1900 Engineering. So first off,
yeah,
why is it called that?
So it's funny. The founder hates the story, but the true story is that the founder's initials are MCM. Which in Roman numerals is 1900.
Oh.
Yeah.
I like that.
I would never have ever guessed.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So that's the reason.
Okay.
I don't know if it's a great reason or whatever. But that's
at least it makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
What are your responsibilities as director of technology?
So a lot of things. We're a small company. So there is everything from working with new clients to understand exactly what they really want, to delivering them the thing that they can actually use. So,
are a lot of the people that are your clients, they don't understand how the technology is working? Is that right? Or like what
sort
you
of.
Do?
So, a lot of them. Let's see here. There's a big range. So, some of them understand that. In order to make these stamps, at some point you do actually need to do microfabrication in the conventional sense. And some of our customers have tried that route, and they're really skilled at something like biotechnology, but to gain a new skill like microfabrication in the traditional sense, using a clean room, is difficult, takes some time. And so they understand that there's that difficulty. They want somebody to help them avoid that difficulty.
Right.
And so we help them out. Other clients, they just know that they want this special pattern on their special part. They asked us for help, and we help them, and they don't really care how it is that we got to the point of shipping them something that fixes their problem. And that's fine, too.
So I have two sort of goofball questions.
Yeah.
One is, how big is the box that a shipment is usually? Like, how much stuff are you sending to a company at once?
Yeah. So we have shipped some boxes that are freight that are, large enough that
go on a truck.
Yeah. And then we've shipped some boxes that are easily held in one hand.
Yeah.
So some things that weigh half a pound and then other things that weigh hundreds of pounds.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So do you ship one stamp or do you ship a pile of stamps?
It depends. Some people do buy one. Some people buy a lot.
Yeah. Okay.
It's amazing to think one stamp, like all that. Where all that history of technology, all of that research, and it's like just one stamp.
And all those customs forms you have to fill out to ship one stamp sometimes.
Oh, wow, that's another show right there. And then my last goofball question, of course, is, do you like being called doctor?
No. So, actually, my wife has called me out on this in the last year, that every time she sees someone call me that, she sees me sort of cringe, and she asked me why, because it's been a while. Like, I've had time to get over this, but I'm not over it. And I don't know. When I was answering her, I said, you know, maybe it's some lingering imposter syndrome. I'm not sure. I just don't like it, though. I don't like it.
Eventually, I'm going to take every response I've ever gotten to that and make some kind of collage.
That'd be awesome.
All right. You're listening to the North Avenue Lounge. We'll be back after a short break.
Tired of listening to the same music over and over? We'll try something different with the EDM Sound System, where we feature the very best underground electronic dance music. That's EDM Sound System every Saturday night from 9 p.m. to 12 a.m. Only on WRAK Atlanta 91.1 FM.
And we're back with Mike Filler and Andrew Cannon, the team that produces the Nanovation podcast. So, Mike, how did Nanovation happen? You were the instigator and the founder.
Yeah. Yeah, well, Charlie, you were motivational in that regard.
I'm trying to downplay my
role. Are you? Okay.
Until it's finally
well, but
revealed.
Charlie helped get me over the hump to actually do it. So I've listened to podcasts for a long time. My kids were born. I needed to get some exercise. So the easiest way to do that was to go run. I didn't have time to drive to the gym or anything like that. So I needed to put some shoes on, go out the door, and the exercise had to start. And I never listened to music much and kind of started to listen to podcasts on running. My wife thinks that's crazy. I love it and keeps my mind off of the running.
Do you remember the first podcast that you really enjoyed?
You know, I probably started with the NPR podcasts, but then, you know, found a couple, you know, techie kind of podcasts and went in that direction for a while. But now I'll listen to everything from tech to politics to storytelling. I mean, it's... whatever. I mean, I think the medium is fantastic, and the fact that anyone with a $40 mic can basically produce something. And to me, it's very analogous to what happened with blogs, you know, 20 years ago. And still today, people look at blogs and like, oh, that's not real journalism. But there's some really remarkable people that write remarkable things. And I think the same thing in podcasting. There's the big players, you know, the NPRs of the world, the what are some of the other Gimlet Media, these kind of places?
Gimlet, Radiotopia, Feral
exactly.
Audio.
And they do great work, but you know, the power of, you know, a low barrier to entry is that you really get diversification. And you can find a podcast on anything that you're interested in. And so I was really enjoying podcasting. And on the other side, if you submit grants to the federal government, particularly the National Science Foundation, one of the things you're required to do is have what's called broader impacts. And so what those mean is, in addition to the impact you hope the science will have, it's how do you impact society and how do you get people to know about what you're doing? And that's kind of where I started to think, well, I have this love for podcasts. Is there a way to translate that into an outreach activity? And that was the start.
Can you take just a moment to describe the importance of grants to your work?
Oh, right. So without them, the work doesn't happen, period.
Yeah.
Right. So you get grants from the federal government. You get grants from companies, philanthropic organizations like the Gates Foundation. If we didn't have these things, we wouldn't be doing this work. And to be clear, this work doesn't happen in companies, right? We're far enough out that it's not of interest to most companies to pursue a lot of the ideas that go on at places like Georgia Tech. And so we need those grants to be pushing the frontiers of science and engineering.
So thinking about broader impacts being required.
Right.
And then you got into podcasts. And this was 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
No, I mean, the podcast, the Nanovation hasn't been around for that long. I think it was the beginning of 2016 when it started. So what are we coming up to? So, yeah, I mean, so it's been... almost three years, I think, doing the podcast. But I've been listening maybe 1 or 2 years ahead of that.
Yeah, okay. So, but it was a kind of a quick turnaround. You sort of were, you interacted with this new platform and then started thinking about launching one.
And it was also having gotten tenure around that time where I said, okay, I can actually.
Now, if anybody didn't hear, Andrew just started laughing when he heard that.
So like I was saying with blogs a minute ago, there's still people that poo-poo it as, you know, something that, you know, is not interesting or cannot be good. And so, of course, there's a variation of quality. But I still have plenty of senior colleagues who ask me why I do this, although that's changing. So when we started, people were like, what are you doing? And now, you know, I'm at a conference and a colleague comes up to me and says, oh, Mike, I didn't realize you were doing this, but I stumbled on it through X, Y, and Z.
Right.
And it's really great. So that stuff's starting to happen now. But in the beginning, and still, there's plenty of people who, just like blogs, view it as something that's not refined enough.
How long did you have to consider whether you wanted to do it as a podcast? Like, was it as soon as you thought, maybe I should do a podcast about nanotechnology, was that obvious right away? Or
I had to really be comfortable and get behind the idea that the internet allows a podcast like ours to thrive. So there's a guy, I think I talked about him on the first episode with you, this guy, Ben Thompson, who writes this blog, Stratechery. Really a fantastic analyst. So this is a guy who's exactly what I'm talking about, who really smart, started analyzing tech business and technology development, and was so good at it that he now gets people to pay for his articles. I mean, he makes a decent living doing this. Smart guy. So one of the things he talks about with the internet is that it enables the rainforest to thrive, in the sense that in a rainforest you have big, gigantic trees, and that's what we've always had. We've had kind of big corporations. But you also now have all this foliage on the forest floor. And that's enabled by the internet, the fact that the nominal cost of an additional byte is $0, right? So innovation is inexpensive to produce, whereas 20 years ago, and you needed to be on the radio, you had to have all the radio equipment, you had to have the what do you call it when you send the signal out?
Broadcasting.
Thank you. You had to have a tower. You had to have a tower, right? And you know, no one was going to pay you or allow you to do that broadcast unless you had 100,000 or a million listeners. Yeah. Right? So shows like Nanovation, which are about nanotechnology, which is, or I should say, nanoscience or nanoengineering, this niche thing would never have thrived in the past. And so today, because distribution is easy, we can do this. So I had to think a lot about what was going to make Nanovation possible. And then there was more thinking about what was the format going to be. Mm-hmm. What could I do as a professor? Because this is not something I get paid to do. This is almost 100% on my own time. But something I felt strongly that we could play an important role in the conversation about nanoscience and nanoengineering, both with researchers and the public, because I'm finding that we're getting both groups of people listening.
And this is why I highlighted service at the beginning, because it does seem like it falls somewhat under service.
But, certainly.
But there is something about it that sets it apart, meaning there is something that about podcasting that someone might say, no, that's not service.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So traditionally, service in academia is, you know, you sit on committees of big, not big, but sit on committees for different professional organizations. So like the American Chemical Society, right? You would do service by sitting on committees for them or organizing symposia for them. And so that's the kind of traditional way people have viewed service. Other forms of service within your school or department would be being on a search committee for a new faculty member. This is like that, but it's kind of outside the box of what people would view as the worthwhile service. Right?
Is that because of the medium, because of the style, because it's just different. An individual...
I think it's just different.
Yeah.
It's just not what people viewed as service in the past.
Now, the way you're describing how you made the decision to start the podcast presupposed that it needed to exist. Because you said you had to convince yourself that it would work,
mm-hmm.
right? And then think of how you might do the format. But right at the start is, why would you think that you should be doing an interview podcast about nanotechnology or nanoscience in your position? It seems like that was sort of ingrained, that you thought you needed to do some project like this.
Well, some of it comes from the NSF requirements. Some of it comes from, I think, the place where most academics get motivated is that they're just excited about something. And this was a way to have those conversations and really actually have conversations. Like we've been talking about how we don't really like the title doctor, right, or professor or trailer faculty fellow or wearing the regalia. Kind of the same thing, that faculty and scientists are real people and average people, and that's their profession. And so allowing people who aren't in science to recognize that we're not strange and that you too can do this because you've heard these conversations. Oh, yeah, there's nothing special about Andrew. There's nothing special about Mike. This is something I'm going to consider now. To me, that is a valuable thing we can do. And I think there's just too much where we put science on a pedestal, it seems unattainable to a lot of people, and that's not good.
So what did you think about when you were considering the format?
Time.
Yeah?
I mean, I was very excited to do it, but then it was a matter of, because there's no career benefit in the short term, how would I do this on the side without taking away from my other responsibilities? So that's where the conversational format came in. Partly, but then conversation is where you get to see who people really are, yeah, right? So that was the other aspect of it, why conversation worked.
Did you ever envision a richly produced storytelling podcast?
I think that sounds fun and would be cool, but I can't imagine how I would find the time to make that work, yeah, without bringing in some sort of resources from an organization or somewhere.
So there's not a draft proposal of Nanovation, the storytelling podcast?
Well, in this point in my career, it's not the thing that I want to spend. Well, if I had more than 24 hours in the day, it would be cool. But right, I have to, again, focus on the stuff that pays my students and pays my salary.
Stop sleeping.
Well, okay, yeah, right.
Yeah, you could do that. So if someone has not heard Nanovation, yeah, yet, either as our showcase or, you know, as a subscriber, how would you describe it? What is the podcast?
Right, so we try and explain in the least jargon possible what does it mean to manipulate matter on the nanometer length scale, right? And how are we doing it today? How do we used to do it? By being better at controlling matter down at the nanometer length scale, what can it enable? What technologies might come from it in the future? And we try and, you know, talk in that space. And we're very loose with that space. Sometimes we're talking about micron scale things, you know, that's 1,000 times bigger than a nanometer. Sometimes we go down a little bit smaller. Sometimes we talk about things related to science that aren't the science. So we've had people on like Fred Rasko talking about publishing. We've had Ivan Oransky from a website called Retraction Watch, where they look for fraudulent science.
That was one of our showcase episodes that we played.
Yeah, one of my favorite episodes to have done. And so we like to have some kind of theme that pulls it all together, but we're also very willing to expand, you know, and push the boundaries of what that means.
What did you have to learn to do, and what felt natural when you started doing the podcast?
None of it felt natural. None of it. I mean,
even the conversation. I mean, did you feel like you could carry on the conversation in a charming and engaging way? Or did you feel like that
I'm
was
an
a
okay
skill?
Talker. I'm yeah. an okay talker. So, you know, I'm pretty good in the lecture hall with students. So I wasn't so worried about that, but there was something about just doing it in front of a microphone that took some time to get used to. So that was part of it.
Yeah. And in the minute we have before station ID, yeah, can you describe the recording setup? What are the tools you use?
Yeah, so it's really simple. A lot of people can do this without much investment. We have I have a couple mics. I have two in my office, one for me, one for a guest if they're there. But oftentimes they're remote, and we use Skype to do that conversation. And I have a little two-channel mixer and amplifier that helps with the audio quality. And then I use my Mac and GarageBand to do the recordings. Actually, I use this app also called Audio Hijack, which is really a great app. To do the recordings and
don't sell anything.
I didn't. I just said it was a great app. So then Andrew, and we could talk about this after the break. But Andrew does the initial edits and or all the edits, and I try and put in the intro So we collaborate that way. But it's really inexpensive, and really anyone can do it. And now you're seeing it with videos too, right? This is happening now with a medium that, you know, 10, 20 years ago you would have thought there's no way that, you know, someone in their basement is going to be doing anything of interest with video. And now we're, of course, seeing YouTube stars.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge. We'll be back in a moment.
How monotonous the sounds of the forest would be if the music came only from the top 10 birds. We give all the birds a chance. WREK, Atlanta.
This is the North Avenue Lounge. My guests are Mike Filler and Andrew Cannon of the podcast Nanovation. Now, Andrew.
Yes.
You started working with Mike after Nanovation was a going concern.
Right.
So were you a listener first?
Yes. I think that I first found out about it on LinkedIn. I think that the Georgia Tech.
That website has a purpose?
This one time, maybe 3 years ago, it had a purpose, yeah. So I think the Georgia Tech account announced that Mike Filler was starting this podcast. So I listened to it right away. Mike's still suspicious of that, but I think that's how it happened. And
you,
so
I didn't even realize it was on LinkedIn.
Were you familiar with Mike when you were a student here?
Not when I was a student here, because he came after I left. But okay. I was familiar with Mike vaguely as a star in the nanotech field. And
he's leaving the studio. Come back, man, come back.
Man. That's at least half true. But So it was cool to see that he had started the podcast. And more than that, I really had been wanting a podcast like that to exist. And then the triple cool factor was that it was from Georgia Tech.
Yeah.
So I knew about Mike. I wanted the podcast to exist, and it did exist from Georgia Tech, which I'm an alumnus from.
And you wanted it to exist because that's your field, right?
Oh, well, or so that, the
that's
reason
your
I...
larger area.
Yeah, there's... So here's the reason I wanted it to exist. So... Like Mike, I'd listen to podcasts a lot. Not while running, because that sounds like a lot of running.
It doesn't feel like a lot of running, because I just forget that I'm running.
Wow. So for me, it's more of on long drives, or if I'm working solo in the lab sometimes, I'll listen to a podcast. So anyways, big fan of the media. And one of the podcasts I listened to was... economics-based podcast, where it was a couple economics professors in the room talking to each other about their work in a non-jargony way. And so, as someone who's not an economist, who's interested in economics, it was really cool to be a fly on the wall. And so, I thought, I sure wish that a science and tech version of this existed, where people could talk about their work as real people. So, then it did exist. I started listening, and... I emailed Mike just to wish him well and say nice podcast. And we talked back and forth over email a few times.
Can I stop you for a second?
Yeah.
Because Andrew was the first person, period, to email me saying that this was cool.
Nice.
So it was like a real pat in the back kind of thing.
Do you remember how many episodes in that was?
It was a couple. It wasn't too far. I mean, it was 3, 4, something like that. And I was like, oh, man. Okay, I got one. I got 5 billion more to go, but I got one. It was nice to know that it was kind of working.
Yeah. Well, that might be a lesson to people to go ahead and reach out, spend 5 minutes to just type up the email, say, good job. Because honestly, I figured he was getting a flood of those sorts of messages, and it was kind of pointless to email him because it'd just be too many. But it turns out I was wrong. And so it was nice as we started talking back and forth a little over email. And then about a year into it, I looked at my feed and I saw there wasn't a podcast episode when I was expecting one, because he was holding it hostage. And and so a month later, I saw there still wasn't another episode left.
Intervention, Mike. This is just history.
Well, we needed an intervention. I mean, that's the point.
Yeah.
Is that I for whatever reason couldn't get podcasts produced on my own, and Andrew kind of asked where they were, and then out of the goodness of his heart and wanting to contribute to the community, said, "Is there anything I can do?" And I was like, oh man, that's quite an offer. And I was like, he's not going to want to do this. And then he said, sure, let's try it. And so we've created a collaborative.
Yeah. What was the first activity. Thing you said you could do? Or actually, let me ask Andrew. What was the first thing that Mike said you could do this to help the podcast? Do you remember?
He asked if I had any editing experience in something like GarageBand. And so it turns out I did, because I had a jam band in Home Park.
Holy cow.
And actually, I played in some Battle of the Bands at Under the Couch when it was actually Under the Couch building.
You and I might have crossed paths.
Cool.
Now that I think about it.
Nice. So I didn't realize that was going to give me the skill set to help out a nanotechnology podcast.
Well,
I did.
I said that, asking if you had any experience, because I had zero experience when I started.
Yeah.
Right. I was just like, I'm going to figure this out. I'm going to read some blogs. Here we go again about how to edit podcasts and do good recordings. And so, I mean, again, the power of the internet is that stuff's out there. So if you want to look for it, it's there. And there's great people who are not quote unquote professionals who know a lot about recording.
Yeah.
So that's where I learned.
Let's take a couple minutes to talk about editing, because it is a remarkable skill. It's an amazing practice, and it doesn't always get, I think, the due that it deserves.
It never does.
Yeah. So, well, let's go with that then, Mike. So how hard was it to start editing the podcast when you were first producing it?
Well, I was really nervous to make sure that what we were producing in the beginning was as good as it could be, right? Because, first impressions are everything. So I spent a lot of time going through. I was not as good on the mic at that point, so I cut some stuff. It's actually one of the things I tell guests. Like,
you literally removed some of the conversations,
exactly.
The audio.
Yeah. So one of the nice things I tell guests to try and make them not nervous when we do the recording is that, look, it's a podcast. It's not going out right now. We can cut anything crazy or incorrect you say.
Yeah.
We rarely have to do that, but, it's a nice thing.
It's a safety net.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So... So that's I wanted it to be good. I spent a lot of time on it. And I think by the time Andrew emailed me, because I hadn't been publishing them, I was still spending a decent amount of time on it. And so there was, in terms of my time, it was the finding guests. It was the prepping ahead of time. It was the recording of the episode, which is an hour, hour and a half. It was the post-production, the editing that we're talking about, and then posting on the website. And so that... combined per episode ended up being probably too much for me to handle, again, when this is supposed to be something that I'm not doing.
Right.
Right. So that's where, when Andrew started asking about it, wow, this is maybe something I should do collaboratively. And I think the show's better because we collaborate on it, because he brings in these ideas for guests, for how to try new topics and all sorts of things like that, that, I would not have thought of myself.
So, Andrew, what do you get when you have to edit an episode? When the whole process is starting, what do you receive that you work with?
Yeah, so we have a shared Doodle Drive folder, and Mike drops in the individual tracks and then also a combined track. And
meaning the two microphones, the two people talking, isolated and then combined?
Yes, okay. Yes. So there'll be three total files there. I'll drag in the individual tracks into Audacity, which is a free editing program, and then I'll make sure that they are synchronized. And
it's an open source.
It is open source.
Editing.
That's right.
Program.
That's
yes.
Right.
I'm sorry, everyone. There are some inside jokes happening inside the studio right now. I apologize.
I'm busy violating FCC regulations.
We will get right back to the show itself.
I've
so Audacity, right, which I also use. I think Audacity is the right combination of robust and simple.
Yeah. So there's some other tracks there that stay relatively static, where Mike introduces the show and tells the listener, thank you for listening, at the very end of the show.
Yeah.
Those stay pretty static. In the middle, there's Mike and the guest talking. And when I'm editing, the main thing that I'm trying to do is imagine that I'm the listener. Do I want to be listening to this? In terms of, well, and what I mean is, if there's a part that's hard to understand, because maybe in
we're
the banter...
laughing, but we totally understand.
Maybe, yeah. Maybe in the banter, in normal conversation where you're sort of talking over each other, the listener probably is not listening very, very carefully.
Right.
And so they may not understand what's being said. And so I might silence Mike for a second as he's laughing or something normal in conversation. But that I think that's going to help the listener take in the conversation better.
Yeah.
Stuff like that.
Do you cut out sections of the conversation ever?
Well, so sometimes. I mean, for example, totally natural things like there might be a question where the guest has to think for a second or stammers for a while before
yeah.
they spit out an answer. And if I were the listener, I think the average listener probably just wants to hear the clear answer. And if I were the guest, honestly, I would probably like to see myself reflected in a articulate person.
As far as I understand this, you know, when you listen to stations like NPR, the reason why people sound as good as they sound is because there's a lot of editing that goes on to make them
yeah.
sound that good, and the ums are taken out and
yeah.
all that kind of stuff.
There's a couple shows that I very much enjoy that I've been able to hear the unedited interviews.
Uh-huh.
And on purpose. It's not like they got stolen or anything,
right.
but just people are like, hey, you want
right.
to hear how this works. And you can hear a host sort of editing themselves in the process,
uh-huh.
saying things like, so how does this, well, wait a minute, let me not ask you like that. I'm going to start again. Let me roll back and I'll try a different tack. And you can hear that.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that's never on air. And there's a certain amount, just like you were saying, Mike, there's a freedom when you tell the guest, we're going to cut out anything that you say that's wrong
right.
or a digression that doesn't work.
Right.
Knowing that you can restart
mm-hmm.
or take out your own fumblings as a host
right.
is very empowering. It just takes the pressure off.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
Unlike right now.
Right, right. I was going to say the other thing that Andrew's done a couple times, which I really like for the episodes that have gone on longer, we don't like the main episode to be more than an hour. So if there's a discussion that's not central to the topic, but it's interesting nonetheless, he'll put it as an after show piece. And so, the ending credits will roll and then it'll go into, a 5-10 minute after show or
yeah.
a couple minute after show. And so that works too.
A little fun thing.
Yeah, exactly.
If you keep listening.
If you keep listening
yeah.
for all the fans out there.
So now that you all have been doing the practice of the podcast, do you hear your favorite podcasts differently? Stuff that you listen to for fun? Is there a way to describe how you hear things now that you're working on a podcast yourself?
I took a lot of pleasure in listening to one of my favorite podcasts, which is very well done, called Invisibilia, when they had a very clear, obvious editing problem.
Oh.
Just because it was like, whew, if these guys have that problem, I don't feel quite as bad at sending yeah. Mike.
An editing from like not being able to make it sound natural when they took stuff out, or what was
They were talking over their own advertisement or something in the middle
of
the podcast.
Oh, yeah, okay. So the actual assemblage was
It was a clear,
off, yeah.
clear mess. Because I was like, yeah. oh boy, I've sent Mike drafts before where he's,
yeah.
very politely let me know that there is a pretty significant problem. In part of the first
yeah.
draft, and I listened to it again and, felt embarrassed. But only Mike heard it, not everybody.
I edit a podcast that I co-host, and I'll send an edit to the other host. We call it the QA edit, the quality assurance edit. And I'm always delighted when I get the email back. No edits. Sounds great. Post it. But
crazy.
Then sometimes I get a, hey, this middle section here, why is this not cut out? And then I go back and listen. I'm like, I must have just zoned out while
yeah.
I was listening to,
yeah.
to the source audio.
Right.
Yeah, it can be very embarrassing. But yeah, we keep it in the family,
yeah.
When it's editing between two folks.
And it's the same way with me. I know Andrew's the only person that hears some of the ridiculous things that I say or not say.
Yeah.
And so that's good. We keep it in the family.
It does feel sometimes like manuscript editing, just in a different kind of realm. Like you are cutting out the awkward language, you're cutting out, metaphorically, cutting
right.
out the awkward language, cutting out the redundancies. Yeah. Do you ever feel like that or?
Yes. Yes. But the thing is, so one of the big differences, this is a little different than what you think you're asking, but so you mentioned manuscript editing and Mike was talking about science communication in the previous section. And to me, when I think about manuscript editing, it's such a formal language that we're using. And I don't think that the average person can get much out of that sort of thing. It's
right.
not even really accessible to them unless they want to pay $40 per per paper that's available on Elsevier or something. And they don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So so anyways, what I think the neat thing about what we're doing is it's such a informal language that the average person can listen to easily, and they don't have the barriers of going online to access these things in a difficult way.
But you were saying this earlier, and I find this with podcasts I listen to in like the politics realm or something like that, that it's not my core area, is if you listen over weeks, you learn stuff.
Yeah.
Just by being that fly on the wall, listening to conversations. And so if you want to learn something about the broad field of nanoscience and nanoengineering, if you listen to Nanovation for weeks, you will be accurately and better educated on that stuff. And I think that's one of the powers of the podcast, particularly the conversational format.
Yeah.
And it's just nicer to listen to while you're learning. So that's good.
This is the North Avenue Lounge. We'll be back after this message.
Go to All In Live at Rec, Tuesdays 10 p.m. Live music, WRAK Atlanta, 10 p.m. Tuesdays.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge. My guests are Mike Filler and Andrew Cannon of the podcast Nanovation. Right before the break, Mike, you said you liked that people could be learning while they listen to it, that if you listen to Nanovation for a certain period of time, you might actually gain some knowledge.
Yeah.
And I want to get back to that. But first, do you want to complain a little bit more about how some podcasts are produced?
Not complain, but just say what I notice. One of the biggest things I notice is the difference between a dynamic mic and a cardioid mic. One, a dynamic mic is picking up what's right in front of the microphone. Uh-huh. So, like right now, this is a dynamic mic, right?
I believe so. I believe that is a Shure or a Sony. I can't. Yeah.
And so, you know, something of me tapping on the table, you're not hearing. And so when you listen to a podcast when they're using a cardioid mic and you can hear all sorts of, you know, paper and stuff like that and kind of you know, that, yeah. That bugs me. Then also I've learned that not everyone is a good podcaster, right? So, you know, it's like blogging. There are lots of great opportunities, but there's some people that I have trouble listening to. And maybe someone else loves it, but that's also, I guess, the pro. You just go listen to something else. There's an infinite amount of material out there.
That's right. And we must always remember never to yuck anyone else's yum.
Exactly.
So tell me about what Nanovation is supposed to accomplish and what you see it accomplishing out in the world.
Well, hopefully educating people.
That is the purpose of the podcast.
Yeah, I think foundationally it is. I mean, the more people understand and appreciate nanoscience and nanoengineering, the better it's going to be for all of us, because it's going to lead to new technologies, and we have to understand the pros and the cons, right? Any technology has a downside and tremendous upside, so we have to be aware of those things. So I think, number one, we're doing that. Other things have happened along the way, right? So not only I've gotten reviews back from proposals I've submitted to the National Science Foundation where people say this podcast thing is a really interesting outreach activity, and even had people who were on the panel and come to me and say, I listened to your podcast after I saw it mentioned in your proposal on a panel I was on reviewing, and I listened. It was really great. So those things are happening, and I was going to say something else, but I forgot. So,
well, I want to ask you this, and let me see how to phrase it. What does it do for you professionally, if anything?
So, I just remembered the last thing I was going to say is that a couple times now, started new interactions with people in the nano space. So, yeah. Kira Barton is a professor at University of Michigan, and Andrew knows her, and so he connected her to the podcast, and it was a great episode. So I highly recommend that people check out that episode. But we realized towards the end, kind of in the after show, the part that wasn't on the podcast, that there was actually some really interesting synergy between her research and my research. And now...
This was just the conversation between you and your guest when the mics were off. Is
correct.
That what you're saying?
That's right. Okay, that's right. And I kind of started to realize it during the recording, but the conversation continued after the main recording was over, and realized that there's this synergy. And so right now, she's part of a team that I'm on, working on a large proposal to the National Science Foundation. And that would not have happened without the podcast. But she has the ideal skill set and training to fill this role in the proposal.
It does feel like all benefits to sort of independent podcasting are secondhand, in the sense that you're not going to make a living off this. You're not going to put your metrics up in your evaluation and get a raise, but it creates a circle of connections.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Andrew, is that the same for you in the, I guess, the commercial sector, we would say, or you're not in academics? So
yes.
How does the podcast and doing the podcast affect your life?
Yeah, so that's true. It is mainly secondhand. So sometimes it just supplements existing relationships that I have. So for example, there was another episode where Mike interviewed someone named Swami Rajaraman, who's at UCF, University of Central Florida. So I've known Swami since we were both grad students at Georgia Tech, working in the clean room together. And so in connecting him with Mike, it started up a set of conversations with Swami that culminated in him inviting me down to UCF to do a seminar on the sort of work that I'm doing at UCF the day before he did the interview with Mike. So, you know, it's just another way to connect with people and to help people out that I care about. And there's also this personal satisfaction part of it too, where, you know, it's important to everyone to see an impact in their work and not just feeling like a replaceable cog. Yeah. And so there's that sort of personal satisfaction where, you know, the podcast was on hiatus for a little while before I came on the team. And so it's nice to see, hey, here's something that I am doing that's actually having an effect.
Speaking of personal satisfaction, I mean, the podcast has been downloaded thousands and thousands of times. I mean, I don't think we're clips 10,000, but we're kind of in the 5 to 10,000 range. And if I think about how many people I teach in the classroom, right? Yeah. I teach 30, 40, maybe 50 kind of thing, right? In a given semester. And that's great. But to reach thousands, right? That's another level. And while there's, you know, no immediate benefit, there are all these secondary benefits that do sum up to matter. And so I think it's great. And it's, at the very least, it's an interesting space. And so what I keep telling my colleagues who wonder about it is that, I mean, it's clearly not been a disaster. has it been wildly successful? I would argue we don't know yet. And it's kind of one of these things where we'll kind of pull on the thread and kind of see where it takes us. And that it's been good enough that we should keep pulling. You just never know where these kinds of things can go.
So let's just do a couple of quick thought experiments. What would a disaster have been?
It's a good question. Zero listeners. I mean, it doesn't take many listeners, right? Especially if they're engaged and eager. And actually, if you get a few, then they multiply.
Yeah,
right?
Because people tell other people, yeah.
Exactly. So it was probably going to be hard to be a disaster. But I think we needed to have good enough production quality, good enough guests that... Even if you don't listen regularly, you walked away from listening to a show and said, that's interesting. And you didn't think negatively of it, even if it was not something you listened to on a monthly basis.
So just to nail it home, though, even a disaster really would have just been you used your time. There really weren't any ill effects.
Yeah, no one would have been hurt in the making of Nanovation.
Yeah,
so I think that's that. But that's the nice thing about the low cost of entry.
Yeah.
So
the subtext to all of this is that you should just buy a guitar and start your own band in terms of podcasting, that it's very easy to start this up, that there is somehow a great potential and a minimal danger.
Correct. Just differentiate yourself. Right. So we're extremely differentiated, right? Almost too differentiated. But there's plenty of science, general science podcasts out there. Some great ones by the bigger podcasting outfits. And so we don't try and compete with them. We try and compete in this narrower space where people are looking for something more specific, deeper conversations about these specific things. And so the production quality is not as good because we're playing in this more niche space. But there are people out there who are very interested. And I think the thing that helped me, that Ben Thompson said from Stratechery, is that, look, there's 7 billion people on the planet. Right, the internet is connecting all of us, and so if you get the smallest fractions of those 7 billion, you have a reasonable number of people listening and benefiting from your work.
Yeah. So, what does the future of Nanovation look like, and what would you like it to look like?
Can Andrew take that?
Yeah.
Well, so something that I've thought about for a while is I would like Georgia Tech to be better represented when it comes to new science stories hitting the daily news. Mm-hmm. Reporter needs a scientist perspective, and they call someone up. So I would love Mike to be on the top of that list for the CNN science reporters.
Have you read the strategic plan for Georgia Tech?
No. Is this a thing?
Well, it is a little bit. And it's just interesting that, I mean, you said it in a completely different way, but the, you know, the phrase, what does Georgia Tech think, is a thing that they're trying to make happen, I guess. You know, so, trying to push that. And the reason I jumped on that is because I find it so interesting that in the academic realm, this sort of like surprise realization that we should be getting people to ask us what we think, that we should invite people, we should make people think that we are experts who can be consulted. It's almost like, oh, why did we have to do this? But there was that drop in people's, I guess, enjoyment of experts. What isn't that the classic line from the Brexit negotiations? I think maybe people are tired of experts.
There's a great book called The End of Expertise.
And so in a way, there's this like reclaiming of proficiency and understanding.
Yeah. Well, and I think that unfortunately we've isolated ourselves in a way. So I think that most of the professors at great institutions share their work at conferences where other experts are, or share their work in publications that you have to have institutional access, a subscription to get those scientific papers. And even if you get them, they're written in a language that's sort of hard to understand in the everyday language. And so I think that, you know, if we can make it a lot less formal and a lot less expensive, then that's a good thing.
Mike, I know you backed away from the microphone when I asked you, but do you have any thoughts on, we got a minute left.
Yeah.
What do you want to see Nanovation become? What would be a win, and what would be a winning lottery ticket?
Oh, man. You know, I think I'd like to see the listenership, you know, higher. I think the guests we've had on have been great, really insightful in a whole variety of areas. So somehow getting our regular listenership up a notch, I think would be fantastic. And I think with that comes some of the things that, you know, Andrew's talking about. But it requires more people to be listening and spreading the word, basically. Beyond that, I don't really know. Remember, my full-time job is as a professor and doing research. And I'm very excited about that research we're doing. And part of Nanovation is to share that. So we'll see. We'll check back in with you and let you know.
Okay. It's a date. You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge. My guests today are Mike Filler and Andrew Cannon, the team that produced the podcast Nanovation. You can find out more about Mike's work and Nanovation at fillerlab.com, FillerLab.com. Nanovation is also featured on Science 360 Radio, and you can learn all about microspeckle stamping. I don't know what that is. Maybe we should find out at researchmicrospeckle.com. Thanks for listening. Thank you.